This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Thank you, Patrice. Thank you so much for coming out, and I'm delighted to be here in the Carsey Wolf Center. And I know everyone here lives in Santa Barbara, but I live, as you can see, in central Pennsylvania. And I have been so excited for the weather for weeks. So I appreciate you coming inside from the to this from the beautiful weather. And I was going to just provide a bit of an introduction about the adventure of this project and talk a little bit about what Japanese paper films are, because before I got involved with the project, I'd never really heard of them. I think very few people within Japan know about them, and certainly people outside of Japan know even less. So two things I'm gonna introduce. One is I'm gonna give you some context for what these films are. And the second thing is I'm gonna talk about our preservation efforts for saving the films. So the story starts in Kyoto in 2019. And I was on a research fellowship there to study Japanese magic lanterns. And I was very, very excited to start my work. And my first day in Japan working was going to the Kyoto Toy Film Museum, which is an amazing place. If you get a chance to go to Kyoto, it's an incredible kind of archive and museum. And the director of the museum, his name is Yoneo Ota. And he sat down with me to talk about my project. And in the nicest, most polite way, mentioned that my project was a terrible idea. And so this is after moving my family 6,753 miles to Kyoto. And I'm really starting to get worried about what I'm gonna tell my wife that evening. But he, Ota Sensei may have had ulterior motives because he took out a box, kind of not unlike this box, and inside the box was a roll of film, not unlike this roll of film. And I realize you can't see it that well, so I'll hold it up here. But this is what a paper film looks like. And you can see that the back is solid. And I'm sure during the Q&A, I will get the question of like, how do you project a film that is solid like that? So we'll talk about that. But he not only had that film, but he had dozens of these films. And I'd never really seen anything like this. And so I was very, very excited. And he mentioned to me, he's like, yeah, I have the projectors for these films. And he showed me those. And I'm like, well, let's watch some of these movies. And he goes, it's impossible. And he explained that the films themselves are now quite old. They're made in the 1930s. And the paper has become very, very brittle. And the kind of splices are very delicate. And the original projectors more or less just kind of shred a film. And so he's like, everyone is afraid to play these movies because we don't want to damage them any further. And so I asked kind of what are the films about or what sort of movies are they? And he's like, we don't know because no one's been able to look at them for 40 or 50 years. So several museums and collectors and archives have saved the films, but they don't know anything about the films. And he showed me what he was concerned about, which was this, that the films are just falling apart. And by the way, just, it's okay, we saved this movie. So you won't see it this evening, but we have been able to preserve this film, but it was kind of like working with a jigsaw puzzle, surgically putting it back together. So the films themselves have a bit of an odd history. There were three main manufacturers. that worked from 1932 to 1938. Two were based in Tokyo, one was based in Osaka. And of course, if you know your history, these were also the two cities that were most firebombed by US forces. So very few paper films survive. They're incredibly rare. The films themselves are 27 millimeter, except when they're 26 or 28. There are live action films, there's animated films, and one of the companies sold blank film with the idea that you would make your own movie. And we have actually found and preserved some of these films. You will see a kind of partial version of one of these this afternoon. They run about 1 to 4 minutes. And there are some films that are multi-part films where it's continued from reel to reel of the film. The films, unlike 35 millimeter film, have the perforations at the top and bottom of the frame. Two companies had a single perforation. One company had two perforations. They each sold their own proprietary projectors. And I'm pretty sure that the company that has two perforations wanted to make sure that you couldn't play films from the other company on their projectors and vice versa. The films themselves are printed on giant sheets and then cut into strips and then glued together every 40 frames. And you could kind of see the outline of a splicing point. 40 frames is 2 seconds of film, roughly. And so somebody all day took one strip of film and glued it to another strip of film. And I imagine that's a fairly monotonous job, because sometimes the film frames line up really nice. Maybe that was films done in the morning. But the films done in the afternoon often are kind of free and loose with how they're joined together. And as you could see, sometimes we have perforations on the top of the frame. Sometimes the perforations float down into the frame. Sometimes there's no perforations at all. So the Japanese paper film project kind of began with this idea of Ota sensei saying, how can we preserve these? How can these be saved? And I realized I needed to build a machine that could do this. Normal film scanners won't work because of the irregularities in the film strip. And I also realized I don't know how to build a machine, because I'm just a film media studies professor. So what I needed to build was a team. And at Bucknell, we were able to kind of, in today's political euphemisms, reach across the aisle to mechanical engineering and to computer science and to East Asian studies. And we built a group that could think about how do we make a machine that could scan these films that's kind of purpose-built for that, and what would this look like? So we came up with a kind of two-part solution. The first part involved hardware, in that the films are so delicate that we knew we couldn't like start the film and then stop it and kind of get it in position to have the frame photographed and then move it again. So we came up with a solution that basically scans the film in motion. So we made a scanner. Our mechanical engineering student, Alina Arco, built this machine that basically allows us to capture the film in motion. This is much gentler on the film. Once it's kind of moving, the film is happy. It doesn't tend to tear or break. And we could capture a whole film in about 8 or 9 minutes. For our purposes, because many of these films are classified as national treasures, we needed a machine that was very light, because we knew the films couldn't come to us, and so we had to go to the films. So we wanted something small, portable, something that could be relatively fast so that we weren't like moving into an archive for a month or two, but instead we could scan their collection in a couple of hours or a day or two. The other part of the solution was software. Because we were capturing the film in movement, that's not a very entertaining way to look at a movie. So what we did is create bespoke software that more or less used machine learning and image recognition to find what we call good frames. So the red is bad, that's a good frame. So we wanted it to kind of align to a kind of arbitrary point and more or less pull out each of these frames once the film strip was lined up. So here we would take all the good frames and line them up together as a kind of new film. And so instead of the raw scan, we get our first stabilization. And this starts now looking like a movie. And from there, we could take that newly kind of composited film and do some real fine-tuned stabilization so that what you see in the green square is nice and stable and watchable. And that becomes our kind of finished film. And from there, we could do kind of normal color grading and kind of final little touch-ups to have a viewable movie. So our machine is called Kyorenren, which is named after a Japanese yokai or spirit. And Kyorenren was a spirit that protected lost or unread scrolls. And the scrolls reminded me of paper films. And so we have updated Kyorenren to, I think, a pretty cool looking dragon thing going on there. And we even added it to our scanner. This is from the mechanical engineers because they had like a laser etcher and they needed something to do with it. So I was like, go crazy. So we added the logo. And the last thing is that the films have sound. Not all of them, but some of the films had these numbers etched into the kind of film strip at the beginning of the film. And what we realized is that these numbers, and it's paper films are printed backwards. We'll talk about that in the Q&A. We realized the numbers corresponded to 78 RPM shellac records, which, if you think paper films are delicate, 78 RPM shellac records are also really delicate. So we started working with lots of people that collected and held paper films, and then we started working with people that held and collected 78 1930s Japanese shellac records. And that's a Venn diagram that does not have a lot of crossover. So we really had to kind of expand the project to figure out sound. And on the back of some of the film strips, those are basically sound cues. So as the film is running through the projector, you can see that little ink stamp go by, and that tells you when to start the record player. So in addition to the films, we have also digitized and restored some of the soundtracks, and you will hear some of those films this evening. A couple of quick program notes. First, tonight's films, they are intensely Japanese. And intensely 1930s Japanese. Because they're short films, they pretty much assumed that the audience was bringing foreknowledge to the movie itself. So there's lots of kind of mythological creatures or famous samurais or historical events that people in the 1930s knew, but that we don't necessarily know. So some of the films have kind of cards before them that explains a little bit what's going on. But there may be some films that just make no sense to you, and that's okay. Just enjoy the music and enjoy the images. The second thing is that this is a preservation project, not a restoration project. So our goal is to scan the films with as high a fidelity as possible, but we don't do any restoration work on them. So you're gonna see dirt, you're gonna see scratches. If you have a really, really, really good eye, you're gonna see fingerprints on some of the films. And we think these material artifacts tell us a lot about the movie. And you'll see one film where the back of the film becomes very revelatory. And we think it's important to keep these artifacts in there rather than to clean them and make them like digitally pure or anything like that. So for us, part of this is knowing that it's both film and paper. And then the final thing is that the films themselves are, some are just adorable. And it's very easy to get seduced by how cute and adorable and enjoyable and pleasurable these movies are. But context is really important. So this is 1930s Japan. The Second Sino-Japanese War is happening. Japan is becoming increasingly militaristic and nationalistic, and leading up until World War II. And some paper films are propaganda films. And we've actually included those in here because we think it's really important to balance out what do these films tell us about this time period. So our kind of curatorial goal was to provide a kind of huge mix of different types of movies. But I wanted to kind of prepare and prep everyone that historical context is always an important thing. And it's still okay to like find them adorable. That's all right. And then finally, I want to bring on our amazing musical guest, Duo Yumeno. Yoko Rekano Kimura on koto and Hikaru Tamaki on cello. They are from New York City and perform together year round. But we are delighted to be able to work with them. And they have done kind of amazing work with composing music, particularly for these exact films. And it's been a delight having them. So please welcome them to the stage. And please hang out after the performance. Alex is doing an amazing Q&A, and we'd love to hear your questions and talk to you about the program. Thank you for coming out this afternoon.
I'm so happy to be here. My name is Alex Lilburn. I'm a graduate student here in the Department of Film and Media Studies and a graduate student researcher at the Carsey Wolf Center. I'm joined by Eric Faden from Bucknell University and Yoko Rekano Kimura and Hikaru Tamaki of Duo Yumeno. And we are so excited to have this project. There's so much we could talk about, but we have about half an hour to talk before we turn it over to the audience for questions. So yeah, let's just get started. I was really excited when I first heard about this project. I think this is like completely unlike anything else in film history that I was aware of. So I just wanna ask, when Eric, you found these films, what was the process of getting this project off the ground?
That's a great question. It was a long process. And I should also mention that, of course, this is a pandemic project. So we were living in Japan until 2019. And so we're just kind of starting and then came back to the US. And so work paused for a long time. So when Yoneo Ota Sensei asked me, he kind of set me up, as I said in the introduction, of, you know, he basically was like, if only someone could figure out some way to do this. And like an idiot, I was like, oh, I could probably do that. The way we got this off the ground is because I was living in Japan and didn't necessarily have a lot of colleagues in terms of resources. I went to the Konan, which is like the Ace Hardware of Japan. I went to Yodobashi Photography, and I stole a whole bunch of stuff from one of my colleagues' desk, and I cobbled together this rig that could let me photograph the films frame by frame. And so I would like move the film one frame and take a picture, move the film another frame and take a picture. And this is, as you can imagine, very labor intensive. It took about 4 to 5 hours per film to kind of take pictures of. And it's also super error prone. So we could make a film, but it wasn't really good. It needed even more work in post-production to get it kind of viewable. So we knew that we needed a kind of more automated process, but that was kind of how it all started, was through a lot of trial and error and manual labor. And I never did tell my colleague about stealing all that stuff from her desk drawer, so we maybe shouldn't let this part, we gotta edit this part of the video out.
And can you explain the concept of toy films and
sure.
why they began making films on paper in the beginning?
I'll try to do this quickly, but Japan had, it wasn't unusual for people to have 35 millimeter film in their homes. So you would have a 35 millimeter projector, and the kind of final profit center for movies and movie theaters is it was too expensive to ship movies back. So after a film had played at a theater, they would take the film and literally cut it into little sequences or scenes and then sell those. So you could like buy them at a specialty shop or buy them at a department store, and you would take them home and you could watch a scene from a movie, or you could cut together a couple of scenes if you wanted to. And these were called toy films. And it's kind of a misleading term because we think toys, you know, children, all of that. But really the term is to designate it from amateur films or homemade movies. So these were feature films. And many of the kind of live action films you saw were probably copies of toy films that they then made into paper films.
And can you tell us about any of any films that you've digitized since you put this project together that you may be showing in the future, or you know, are
a lot
just archived?
Yeah. So we basically work the kind of student team that I supervise. We do about 4 to 5 films a week is what we're able to kind of process and basically do that really fine tuning so that it's ready for exhibition. So I think the program tonight is 28 films. We've done slightly over 200 films that we've saved. And so there's just an incredibly eclectic range of things. We do have several kind of hand-drawn films, which are fascinating. And I guess I mentioned to Alex beforehand, but I did a Q&A a couple weeks ago, and every question was, I don't know, because this looks like a nice complete program, but nobody could study these films until you could see them. And so every film is a kind of research rabbit hole that's tempting to kind of go down. And right now our focus is just finishing and preserving the films. And we're really excited about kind of opening the films up in the future and inviting other scholars and archivists and researchers and just fans to help us kind of do research. But to answer your original question, there's just too many rabbit holes to go down.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're really lucky to have the live musical accompaniment by Duo Umeno. I think it's a really... You know, so you are on a tour across the U.S. and you plan to do Japan in a few months.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
How did Duo Umeno become involved in the paper film project?
Oh, maybe Yoko.
Okay. Yeah. I think it was the beginning of last year.
It's almost a year ago.
Yeah. So Eric Sensei, Dr. Faden, emailed me, so Yoko-san, if possible, could you join this project? So he explained as a detail about this project. And immediately I realized Japanese paper film is very, very rare. Mm-hmm. And because my husband, Hikaru, he's a big fan of cinema. And so we sometimes watch very unique films, but we never
see paper films.
So I responded immediately. I really like to join this project. Yes, and as a very first performance was only me, but. I thought it might be better to have Hikaru because the music will become more rich.
And we were already performing together as a duo for many years.
And some of you might notice I need retune during the performance. So sometimes he can add more melody lines or I can have enough time to really turn carefully. Yeah. So we can work together very well.
And you two have never scored film before this, is that correct?
Right, yeah, mm-hmm. This is our first,
And how does the experience of playing for film differ from what you usually do?
We're pretty much bound by the duration of the film. So, so we're literally accompanying the what's going on visually. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem like such a, I don't feel really inhibited by that. It's actually quite pleasurable to add emotional, dimension to these films. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, we really enjoy it.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Oh.
I just wanted to interject one thing. It's been, as a non-music person, it's also been really fascinating to watch you all go from like the first, second, third, fourth show, the music's really grown in mm-hmm. a like really beautiful way. Mm-hmm. And so, I think we're like firing on all cylinders now, but it was interesting to kind of watch it kind of find the films. Mm-hmm. It's lovely.
Mm-hmm. And what was the process of scoring the films like? I noticed some motifs, but mm-hmm. was there any improvisation or have you composed everything beforehand?
Yeah, so when I first joined this project, so it was a little challenging to me, but at the same time, it was very, very fun to watch these films. So at the very beginning, so I recorded improvisational singing to iPhone.
She recorded on an iPhone while watching the film.
So I sang during I watched the film, so tan tan ta 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 ta, like this. And I transferred to Koto, so if it is a very possible or not, and I shaped up. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, the basic framework, I think most of it Yoko did, and I kind of added the cello part. But I did some. Mm-hmm. I added some new melodies and
And also here and there we added very famous folk song. For example, the moon, ta 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 ta. So this melody line evokes beautiful moon shining, so most of Japanese people realized, this is moon immediately. So, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, so for Chūshingura, samurai's fighting scene, so I choose a very famous classical piece titled Yachiyo Jishi, because this piece is often used for fighting scene at the Kabuki Theater.
Mm-hmm. So some of these films had a soundtrack with them. Mm. And there was also a practice around this time in Japanese cinema of the benchi. Can you talk a little bit about the benchi and maybe
sure.
some of the things we saw?
Sure. So in Japan, especially as a kind of more, it's a country that joined, had a very isolationist policy and kind of slowly joined in with the West and trade and so on and so forth. But with new media, like cinema, there was a tendency to try to kind of normalize it or explain it. And this developed into a narrator, especially during the early cinema period, that would kind of narrate the films to explain to audiences, here's what's going on. And this continued into the sound era in Japan. And in fact, benchi, there were hundreds, possibly thousands of benchi. And in some cases in major cities, the film wouldn't be advertised, the benchi would be advertised. So people, they didn't care what the movie was, they were going to see certain performers and narrators, and many of them were like rock stars of their time. So when sound came in, Japan actually held on to the benchi tradition for a very, very long time, well past the kind of innovation of sound films. But eventually, the kind of sound technology won out. And so benchi started moving into kind of different types of jobs, one of which is recording soundtracks like for these, where they narrate the films, as you heard. But there's also a practice called kamishibai, which is like a kind of neighborhood theater where it's actually super cool. You'd be on a bicycle, and you had like a proscenium theater on the back of your bicycle, and you would bike to a kind of neighborhood street corner, and you would then tell the story, and you had these cards that were in the kind of box, and you would narrate. And for me, it's a kind of different type of paper film. But this was enormously popular. Kamishibai did live performances to over 1 million people a day in Japan after World War II. So benchi kind of transitioned into that role as well.
And you mentioned some of the films with soundtracks with narration, but those were done by benchi.
They were, yeah. So we have some of the archives have little booklets that came along with the albums. And the booklets tell us about who the benchi was, and it has the transcript of their narration and stuff like that.
And I want to go back a little bit to the technical side of the paper films. Can you explain how the projector worked that originally projected these films?
Yes. So I'm going to use hand things here. So so let's pretend this hand here is like a strip of celluloid film. The way it normally works is you have a light source, big bright light behind the film strip. And the light goes through the film strip, that light goes into a lens and projects up onto a screen. But paper films are opaque, they're solid, so you can't put a light behind it because you wouldn't project anything. So instead, the light is in front of the film strip, and it's very, very bright, and it basically produces so much light that it bounces the light from the film strip into a lens. And that's what projects it up on screen. I had never seen anything like this. And I have to admit, even at the Toy Film Museum where they're first showing me the projector, I needed to have it explained to me three times because I was like, that just can't possibly work. But it does. And so it's really kind of amazing, but it is very counterintuitive. But it does produce an image. Very cool.
And how are the films? So we had a mix of animation and live action. I'm curious about the process of actually getting the images onto the film. So in the case of live action, for instance, is there celluloid somewhere in the process? Or
yes, absolutely. So what they're doing is they're taking, first of all, I should like shout out to one of my colleagues in Japan, Tsuyoshi Yamabata, who is a PhD candidate and is actually doing his dissertation on how the films were printed. And he has uncovered some really amazing work. So the really great answer to this question is going to be in about 2 years when his dissertation is finished. But the way it worked is they used what was called a photogravure process, which creates a kind of almost like 3D embossing of light and dark. And so you can put a film strip on this, and then from there you can do an ink pressing onto paper. And that's how they would take the live action film. So they would take the 35 millimeter film strips, do a photogravure process, and then be able to print on paper from there. One thing that is, I'll end there. We could keep going with other questions.
Okay.
I don't want to go down too much of a rabbit hole on photogravure.
In the case of animation, is it much simpler that it was just done by hand?
Yeah, so that was just drawn and then printed. And so all of the companies that were making paper films were coming out of the printing business, not so much the film business. So the films were printed on these kind of like giant sheets and then cut by hand into strips and then glued together.
One thing I wanted to ask is the kind of afterlife of these films. So we saw one instance where a film from the one that had been hand-drawn on the back of one of the paper films that was from the 50s, clearly.
Yes.
What was the afterlife of the paper films in the decades following World War II?
It's a great question. We don't know much. I mean, films like what you saw tonight, this afternoon, the hand-drawn films, are in some cases like a historical treasure trove because they tell us there was an afterlife that we didn't necessarily know. We've seen some accounts, kind of anecdotal accounts of people that remembering these from their childhood. And the films, the way they were projected is they were hand cranked, and we've managed to collect one story where if you don't crank fast enough, you know you're not going fast enough because you could start to smell the paper burning. And so that was your cue to, like, you know, go faster so that the film didn't catch on fire. Those stories are kind of from the late 40s, early 50s. Mm-hmm. So we know that it lived on a little bit after the war, but I'm willing to bet things like television, which was originally called Dinky Kamishibai or Electric Kamishibai, probably replaced the idea of watching movies at home or kind of in neighborhoods for that. And then we think by the 80s or 90s, the paper was probably too delicate to really try projecting anymore.
Well, I mentioned earlier that you're now touring. So you're headed to LA tomorrow. Showing in LA tomorrow.
Yep.
How has the experience been, especially with the live music, how has the experience been on the road, and what's the reception been like of the project?
I'll let Yoko and Hikaru speak to that.
We really enjoying this project. We perform contemporary pieces, and sometimes we perform our commission piece and also already existing pieces, and the chamber music, at the chamber music concert series. But performing for this project is the audience, the feedback is a little different from the chamber music concert series.
We usually don't get people laughing when we're playing. Usually.
So the people enjoy the films and also probably enjoy our music too. So it's a kind of chemistry. Mm-hmm. So both our films and our music. So it's pretty different from our usual performance. So I really enjoyed.
Yeah, and it's very different from places to places. The reaction is always slightly different, and we always enjoy that subtle difference.
It's sometimes a very academic atmosphere. After Q&A, so everybody gets come to our.
Today was very lively.
It was
very.
We won't name names.
Very enjoyable to perform.
I think for me, I mean, it's been surreal because I'm an academic. We don't do things like this normally, and I never imagined myself as tour manager, and I'm also teaching this semester. So we play kind of like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then I fly back to teach class on Monday, Wednesday. And my students have no idea that I do anything like this. So they would be shocked if they found out. But it's been an absolute delight. And like Hikaru said, it's really fascinating to see the reactions. And we've actually learned a lot from the audiences where they will occasionally come up and comment and say, like the live action film that looks very much like a kind of ethnographic documentary we had an expert in the audience that was an anthropologist, and it's like, I know exactly where that is, and we didn't. And in many ways, this project, you know, seems like, as I mentioned, kind of put together, but it's really the beginning of research on these films. Now that we can finally see them and watch them, we could actually have kind of other experts and kind of researchers start helping us fill in the historical blank. So it's that also has been a really pleasurable part of being able to show these films to a wider audience.
And on that note, you're planning on presenting this at the Pordenone Silent Film Festival this year. So what's the idea for the immediate future of the project?
So we have, we're taking a break for while I grade papers for a couple of weeks. And then we're in Japan for four weeks, where we have, I think, six cities and maybe 10 or 12 shows to tour it in Japan, which for me, this is like full circle of finally being able to return these movies mm-hmm. and be able to show them to the home audience. And I'm very excited to see how that goes. We have East Coast in September, then Italy in October. And we are, I think, putting the final touches on a multi-city tour in Australia. So, like I said, my students are never gonna believe any of this this part. But the other thing that we're hoping to get off the ground with a kind of foundation called the Yanai Initiative is building a kind of public database so that people could actually see the films, kind of, we could add in the bibliographic information and really open it up so that other people can contribute their knowledge to helping us fill out areas that I'm simply not an expert in. And part of this project has been really interdisciplinary, and lots of kind of hands came together to make this happen, and we're excited to have even more hands coming in to help contribute to the project.
I'm gonna go ahead and ask my last question, because
sure.
I imagine there are questions from the audience. So I'm wondering how the project has been received in Japan, especially from the collectors and museums that you've been working with. What has the response been to having these films digitized?
I have to say, I'm not going to get like emotional here, but when Yoneo Olta Sensei first kind of tricked me into working on this project, you know, he said his dream was that one day that him and I could just sit down and just finally watch these films together. Mm. And that's been one of the most fulfilling things in my life. And another big collector, Natsuki Matsumoto Sensei, I remember kind of demonstrating the machine for him the first time, Kyo Renren. And he basically said, I've been waiting 30 years for this.
Oh.
And it, like, you know, I'm good with the rest of my life to have someone like that say something, because he's just a extraordinary kind of scholar and collector of early cinema and Japanese materials. So that's incredibly gratifying. And I think approaching this project, especially as a non-Japanese person, has been to try to be as kind of cooperative and collegial and respectful of how valuable and important these materials are. And we've just been incredibly welcomed. And it's been just a fantastic collaboration. The last 2 years, Bucknell has allowed students to come with me, and they've been able to do kind of hands-on kind of archival work and helping with scanning the films. And that's just been amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, everyone, so much for joining us here. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Emily Zinn, who will take audience questions.
Hi, I was wondering if you know if anywhere else in the world has the paper film technology?
Great question. Short answer is no. France has some interesting stuff, sort of, kind of like it, but has a completely different approach. There are a couple of examples of films that instead of being projected, they were paper, but you would just kind of look into a box and it would kind of move along. I will say, Yoneo Ota Sensei at the Toy Film Museum has shown me one film that they have. I'm not going to get tricked into doing the next project for him, but it is made on rice paper and it's translucent, and he has never seen anything like that before, and I have never seen anything like that before. And it's not really what you would call animated film, but it's kind of like frame by frame of like different scenes, but clearly it was meant to be projected in some way. So that's going to be the next exciting project that he's probably will get me to work on.
Thank you so much for being here, everybody. Beautiful, moving, charming music. Why was paper used, and in what venue were these films shown? What were they used for?
So, toy films, I was mentioning earlier that people would bring 35 millimeter film into their homes. So that was made out of nitrate, which is very explosive and can actually spontaneously combust. So it's not a great, I don't know. I mean, my kids probably would have loved it, but it's not necessarily a great thing to have in your house. And so paper films, we've seen some early advertisements where they're advertised as a safer type of film to have in the house. Not that paper doesn't also burn, but I guess it's less explosive in its burning. Most of the films were shown in homes, but we have, for instance, the paper film that had the back with the prices. That seems to indicate these were being shown in a neighborhood or kind of maybe street corner. So we think that maybe one family would get the projector and the other families would buy the films, and there would be kind of group screenings of the movies.
This question's for Yoko and Hikaru. During the composition process, I noticed you guys had crafted a lot of sound effects, especially during the ship sequence and the air balloon sequence. Mm-hmm. And I really thought that was quite wonderful. What was the process of creating those sound effects, and how much time did you feel like it took you to get there for that?
Actually, we do lots of contemporary music with you know, extended techniques, and as you might have seen, koto, it can be used in very effective way to add different kinds of timbre. So yeah, it was kind of a mostly spontaneous things that we noticed what was going on, and
yeah. so it sounds like extended techniques, but actually it's pretty traditional techniques.
Mm-hmm.
So we already do, for example, I did a beautiful technique called Waren, called shoot.
Like wave sound.
So wave sound, so we call Waren, so Wa means a circle and the Ren means a sequence. So this shu sound sometimes evokes the sound of waves or sound of wind. So, and so in traditional pieces, we already have this kind of technique. So, so to me and to us, so it's very natural, this kind of techniques matching this kind of emotion. So koto has only 13 strings, so sometimes I have to retune, but this is not convenient. But I think so So we can make original tuning system. So depending on the atmosphere, so it's inconvenient, but it's very very useful at the same time. Mm-hmm.
And I should mention the program itself is very much ordered and sequenced to help accommodate different tunings. So different films are kind of like, we'll have some sound films if Yoko needs to do a kind of major retuning of the koto for the movie that follows. So it's curatorial organization, sometimes for musical reasons and sometimes for thematic reasons.
Has anybody tried making any new paper films to test out the original projectors?
Yes. So I mentioned the student Tsuyoshi Yamabata, who is doing his dissertation on this. He's a really interesting person, and it's been a pleasure working with him, but he decided one day, I'm just going to photocopy a paper film foot by foot for all of the feet, and then I'm going to cut them up, and then I'm going to hole punch. And he works at a museum, the Itabashi Science Museum, and so they decided to just make an exhibit out of him. So they just put him in a kind of like glass, plexiglass thing, and he just all day worked on cutting these films. So it became a kind of performance art piece unintentionally. But at the end of it, he had a complete kind of copy on what we might call safe paper that could then be run through a projector. And so if you go to Tokyo, you could go to the Itabashi Science Museum and see a kind of replica paper film run through a 1930s projector. And he's a great person for doing something like that and then having the idea that this should be performance art. So he's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you for a really remarkably wonderful performance today. I just wanted to ask about, you have the subtitles in English. I wanted to know about whether you're doing that with all of them, who's doing that and that part, as well as for Japanese audiences, there are still a few, benshi, mm-hmm. And are you thinking about adding in anything with, some kind of creative project where benshi voices would be added to any of these?
Amazing that you asked that. So the summer tour in Japan this summer will have benshi. The Yanai Initiative last year organized a tour of benshi across the United States, and so we are collaborating with them. The Japan tour will be a bit different in that we will have still music, some films with music and benshi, some films with the original soundtracks, and possibly even doing some film half benshi, half original soundtrack, so people could kind of hear how it transitions. In terms of the Japanese, my colleague Elizabeth Armstrong at Bucknell University did the kind of first rounds of subtitling for the film. And then Toru Kawamoto at Osaka City University did the kind of final approvals. And subtitling is hard. Subtitling is hard. But these films, because they were hand cranked, it's especially challenging to try to get all the subtlety of the Japanese. And somebody was here that is Japanese because you were laughing at Animal Olympics for some lines that we hadn't subtitled. So I know you're out there. But we, in the subtitling, we tried to be as kind of both translating into English as well as translating the spirit of kind of what's being trying to be conveyed on there. So we had kind of two rounds of subtitling. And I will say Animal Olympics was a gift, because our biggest challenge is figuring out how to sync the soundtrack with the speed of the film. Because they were hand cranked, we don't know the speed. And every time that dog barked, or there was a wolf or whatever, it gave us a synchronization point. And so I really love that film because it synced together. One of our audio supervisor is a person named Ryan Hullings, who's with the Criterion Collection. He's the audio supervisor for Criterion, and he thought this would be a special challenge to work with 78 RPM shellac records. And I remember him seeing Animal Olympics the first time and getting a kind of nod from him of like, really good synchronization on that one. So so I will always be very fond of that film.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.